Listen again for God's word to us this morning through our New Testament reading from the book of Matthew, chapter 28. After the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was dawning, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to the tomb. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descending from heaven came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. For fear of him, the guards shook and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid. I know that you are looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He is not here. He has been raised, as he said. Come see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples. He has been raised from the dead, and indeed he is going ahead of you to Galilee, and there you will see him. This is my message for you." So they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came to him, took hold of his feet, and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." This is the word of the Lord.
All of you with bells, put your bells down and just stretch it out a little bit after that anthem. That was a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Whew. April 16th, a young couple just in their 20s and just shy of a year into their marriage are caught up in the wonder and delight of their new baby daughter, just 5 days old, a beautiful baby by all accounts, a joy beyond measure, I'm sure. The young couple was living into a bright future. Midway through seminary for the young man, he was following in the footsteps of his father and his grandfather before him. And this new baby, well, she made the years stretch out with just all the more promise. The wonder and delight of new life, of new possibilities, of love that captures our deepest affections and tells us who we are in ways we never thought we could imagine. That was the spring of 1959, a taste of heaven, to be sure. 57 years ago, just a few days into the summer of 1960, that same couple, in the midst of graduation from seminary and anticipating life's next chapter, well, they entered into experience that was like hell on earth. Their daughter, now a couple of months into her second year, was into her first year of life. She was 14 months old, was sick. A vortex of moments. What seemed like a simple cold and a routine visit to the doctor the next day became a hospitalization, and then after that, a few more days passed, and a horrible diagnosis, leukemia. And just a few days later, she was gone. That young couple was my parents, and that sorrow helped to form me and my three sisters as we came into the world after that. I never knew my oldest sister, and neither did my other three sisters, but she deeply shaped us. It is from her that I learned to anticipate grief and to walk slowly in its wake. It is from her that I learned life is not fair, and innocent people get sick and suffer and die. It's from her that I learned about the depths of love someone can have for another, of how new life can fold out of even the worst possible death. In many ways, my sister, Allison Truly Mount, was my first teacher of the resurrection. It is her ghost that showed me that space within each of us that yearns for a way to trust the power of a love that never dies and of a life that goes on forever. Now, this has not been a simple set of lessons in my life. I'm guessing your own brushes with resurrection's mystery have not been simple for you either. You see, we Christians come to the joy, the elation of Easter Sundays by the hardest of roads. The road that teaches us of harsh injustice, of a terrifying kind of suffering, the kind that feels like it could be the thief of any semblance of hope we have left. The kind that seems to mock God's promises of redemption. The kind that makes real joy seem like a stranger to us. Friends, we cannot rise up to the vivid truth of Easter without abiding first in the shadows of the cruelty and injustice that this world seems to dole out with horrible consistency. Now, if someone were to ask you, why are you a Christian? Where would resurrection come into your answer? And what about joy? Where have you seen dry, brittle bones come to life? Where have you seen the Lord? Resurrection has never been settled doctrine. Its mysterious power and truth have always taken on a variety of forms and answered a range of life's hardest questions. And it has always been something that calls each person into a profound inner discovery in which we find resources we would not otherwise know we had. Now, resurrection is not an idea unique to Christians. In Jewish writing late in the exile and even after the exile, we begin to see flirtations with concepts of resurrection. And it was most often the answer to the profound quandary of why divine justice seems such a stranger to the way the world actually works. This disconnect, this dissonance, this repetitive reality that tells us again and again that the wicked prosper, that innocent people suffer, that lives can be cut short by the cruelest of turns, that people too often use their power to do great harm. Well, all of this can become too much to bear. And the human questions cry out, how long? And why? And so mythic stories began to emerge in later Jewish antiquity with a variety of ways to understand resurrection's purpose. Vindication, reward or punishment, or a way to redeem a battered nation. Ezekiel's experience of the valley of dry bones coming to life was a message to the people of Israel. They were deportees, after all. They were oppressed and violated by the powers and principalities. And the message is clear. Your despair will be transformed. Nothing stands outside God's power and capability. Now, while the idea that God can do anything flows easily from our Jewish roots, the Christian experience of resurrection carved out new territory because it made a claim that this resurrection was not just for a single individual or a family or even a nation, but that its change is universal, even cosmic. The cosmic impact of Jesus' resurrection was meant to expand the reach of God's love, to enlarge our human capacity to share that love, to receive that love, to be conduits of it. This was not meant to contract the world or constrict the world. Jesus' resurrection is not about history. It is not about science. And it is not even about church dogma. And it is certainly not about closing the doors of heaven to people we feel inclined to say lie beyond the pale. The resurrection power that Christ shares in the world can indeed be dangerous if misunderstood. Because it is a cosmic shift, an earthquake at the core of human aspiration and belief. And a true encounter with resurrection doesn't just change the way we die, it changes the way we live. This is a message of freedom, brothers and sisters, not a mechanism of exclusion or oppression. And the empty tomb is not what gives us this joy, this freedom from death's sting. Because you see, an empty tomb can be explained a lot of ways. And Roman officials did just that with their accusation that Jesus' body was stolen by his disciples to create the appearance of his resurrection. All the stories of Jesus' post-resurrection appearances to people, well, these can't really be harmonized. Some of them even contradict with each other. Early Christians, however, were attesting to some things that are very important for us to note today. The first is that Jesus' death was real. He really died. The second is that Jesus was not resuscitated after death. There were many resuscitation tales. Those were not uncommon in the time. They were good news for individuals, good news for families, but they did not change lives across generations, and they did not start a new world religion. The other thing that the early Christians attested to was that Jesus did not just resume his previous life. He began a whole new mode of existence. And finally, and most importantly for us today, Jesus' resurrection didn't just happen to Jesus. It happened to his followers. It happened to the whole wide world. Jesus' resurrection is a source of power. It empowers us. It frees us to live in an in-between time and space that participates in a love that never dies. It's not because he was not in that tomb. It's not because he was not there. It's because he is here. Loose in the world, sharing a love powerful enough to fuel a movement that has changed hearts and lives for more than 2,000 years now. Now, with such powerful love and freedom and joy infused into the world in the Jesus we claim to follow, help me understand today how Christians have morphed into the world-renowned party poopers of the planet. In one study, 90% of people, ages 16 through 29 experienced Christians as judgmental, which was defined as arrogant and self-righteous. Another more recent study found that children from religious families are particularly prone to being less kind, more punitive, less altruistic. These statistics do not sound like resurrection stories to me, nor are they a glimpse into an expanded world or a world more infused with a love that encourages new life, freedom, courage, not to mention joy. Where is the joy? Resurrection expands life's reach. It does not contract. It does not constrict. We know resurrection's mysterious power by the courage and vitality that it unleashes in the most unlikely places. In places where we are hard-pressed to see anything but death. Thomas was 10 years old on a spring day like today, walking with a friend through a field when they decided to climb the tower of a high-tension electrical wire to see what they could see. That expanded horizon must have been beautiful to behold. At some point, Thomas slipped, and a piece of his clothes got hung on the high voltage tower. When he reached up to try to free himself, thousands of electrical volts coursed through his little body. He fell 100 feet with his clothes on fire, almost every bone broken, almost every inch of his skin burned, almost all internal organs damaged. There was little hope that Thomas could or would or even should survive. The Harvard-trained surgeon who cared for Thomas at the Shriners Burn Institute in Boston, well, he described this place where he was doing his residency as hell on earth. When Thomas arrived, the doctor and his team spent days doing painstaking skin grafts from human cadavers, trying to keep Thomas alive long enough to grow skin grafts from his own skin. But there was just too much skin lost, and Thomas was rejecting the foreign grafts more and more quickly. And the doctors agreed. Death would be a merciful release for this 10-year-old. Thomas's catastrophic accident had really put a lot of stress on his family. So much that his 42-year-old father died suddenly of a heart attack. Thomas's mother called the doctor to tell him what had happened, and she said, "Is there any point in trying Thomas's father's skin for just one more chance to save my son?" After much consternation and much debate, the medical team decided to try this procedure. Perhaps there was some flicker of hope, or maybe it was just scientific curiosity. Now, Thomas had been in a coma since the paramedics got to him when he fell, so when he started to try to move his limbs and speak, only a few hours after the surgery, the doctor rushed to his side. Thomas was trying to talk. When the doctor could finally make out what he said, he heard the words, "What happened to my father?" The doctor didn't have the right heart to give him the cruel news that his father had died, so he lied and said, "Your father is fine." "Are you sure?" said Thomas. "I'm sure," said the doctor, "and he'll be so happy to hear that you're improving. My dad's just standing there at the end of my bed. Why won't he say anything?" "Thomas," the doctor said, "where do you see your father?" "He's standing right there. Hi, Dad." "Thomas, your dad has passed away," the doctor admitted. "He died 3 days ago of a heart attack." Thomas's voice grew small and almost impossible to hear. "Then that must be his ghost waving back at me." What a holy moment. A moment of unexplainable power. Love weaving together heaven and hell. Thomas did not reject the grafts from his father's skin. And he went on to become the only child in that burn unit to leave it permanently and re-enter life. And he became the first human being in medical history to undergo an experimental skin replacement procedure the doctors were able to try on him. Thomas left the burn unit severely disfigured, and he went on to learn and to grow, even to be an honor student in his public school in Philadelphia. But the most startling testimony is Thomas's smile. A smile that the doctor saw in a chance encounter with Thomas years later. And Thomas's smile tells the story of a mysterious and powerful joy. The doctor saw the smile of someone who's happy to be alive. Such mysterious and vital joy from a place where human rationality could only strain to see anything but suffering and death. Where do we let ourselves see and believe in the power of this kind of love? This kind of love that defies death. Where do we let ourselves stand in that love that can be in that mysterious liminal collapse of space and time where resurrection stitches beauty into our pain, our loss, into our limited ways of seeing and knowing things, and gives us something that seems such a stranger to us so much of the time? Joy. How willing are we to believe such joy to be true in a world so laden with broken bodies and broken hearts? Joy comes when we trust that God is in the world at work this way all the time. Not just when we recognize it, not just when we trust it. It's a love that sings to dry bones and to bodies that seem better off dead, and to a grief that can't be spoken, and to a suffering that feels like too much to bear. So Easter is calling us, Grace Covenant, to live, to breathe, to sing of this mysterious, magnificent, majestic way of love. And so our Easter Sunday is nothing, my friends, if not a startling sensation that washes over us anew. I can't describe it to you. You and I can't package it or contain it or control it. But when we open ourselves up, when we give ourselves to it, we feel it, we taste it, we see it, and we will never be the same. Jesus was trying to tell us something that remains a very difficult reality for us to receive and to trust. You and I live and breathe eternity every single day, in life and in death. And it's more than resilience. It's more than a second chance. It is the fear and the joy in the midst of a mother's grief that gives her legs the strength to run and tell those who had felt like giving up, "I have seen the Lord." So rise up, Easter people. Really rise up. And let's sing to a world about the mysteries and the power of a love that never, ever dies. Thanks be to God.